So good morning. My name is Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here. Thanks for being here this morning with us. We're in a series, as you can tell, called Romans, and we call it Romans because it's named after a letter that is in the Bible that was written by an early eyewitness of the resurrected Jesus to a church that was living in the city of ancient Rome. The author's name is Paul, and he was a key leader in the early church movement, and this letter that we're reading was written to an ethnically, culturally, socioeconomically, racially diverse church living in Rome. And Paul wrote this letter to remind the church, because we always need reminders, every day, multiple times throughout the day, we need reminders of the gospel of grace, the good news of God's grace. And we're going through this letter in 2017 because this is the year of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And though we don't make a huge deal about the Reformation here as a church, the Reformation was a time when the church rediscovered the gospel of grace. And this letter was an important means through which that rediscovery took place. And that rediscovery reshaped the whole world. And one of the things we're praying for as we go through Romans is that we as a church in our valley would be renewed by the grace that this letter talks about. Now, the first part of this letter, chapters 1 through 11, are mostly about who God is and what he has done in sending his Jesus, what he's accomplished. And it's about how to be right with God. And at the core of the truth of this letter and the core of existence is that every human being has sinned against God who made us. And God, who is remarkably, astoundingly, and ferociously freely giving grace to us at great cost to himself, has done everything necessary to restore the relationship that we have with him. God has done everything necessary to overcome our rebellion against him and its consequences. And if you're new at Faith Community and you haven't read through the first part of Romans, I just highly recommend that you would take some time, grab a Bible, and take it home and start reading it. And also, all of our sermons from the series are on our website, fcchudson.com. You can download them and stream them, just to get a picture of God's grace and what he has done. Because in chapter 12, and where we're at today in this letter, the focus shift changes. And so what Paul is doing in this letter now is talking about, okay, if all this is true about who God is and what he's done for us, this is therefore how we live. The gospel is like the mother in that video teaching us as children how to live, to discover the beauty of God's grace and how to live within it. In our context today in Romans 15, Paul is going to show us how God's grace empowers us to love and care for others when relationships are hard and messy. Now, this is something we all need resources to deal with, because eventually we will all find ourselves in relationships where we seem to be giving more than we're getting out of it. What do you do in those times? Or you find yourself in a relationship that's costing you more than you thought it was going to cost you, and the returns are not very high. What do you do? What do we do when a relationship is hard to be in, where we might be more hurt by the person than helped? What do? Do we stay hoping the relationship will change with time, or do we leave assuming that the relationship will just never change? Well, Paul, in this section, Romans 15, is going to show us that Jesus teaches us how to relate when relationships are hard. Now, before we continue on, I want to make one very important clarification. As I talk about how to love when relationships are hard, it's because we all experience hard relationships. But if you are right now in a relationship with someone who displays a pattern of abusive behaviors, emotionally, physically, sexually, financially, verbally, that's not a hard relationship. That's abuse. And even though what Paul says here shapes how to behave, the gospel offers great hope to violent people, and what you need is more than what the sermon can provide.
get safe as quickly as you possibly can and get help as quickly as you possibly can. There are 800 numbers to help you. Call in the church office. We'll find you the resources as well. But your abusive relationship isn't hard. It's more than hard. And you need more help than just what this sermon can give. Now, with that important clarification made, what do we do when relationships are hard? Jesus gives us an example to follow. He shows us a relational focus. He gives us two extremes to avoid. And he tells us, Paul tells us about the perfect neighbor. We're looking at page 949 of the Bibles in front of you. Again, Romans 15, verses 1 through 9a. So just be the first part of verse 9. If you don't have a Bible, the Bibles are there. We'll also have it on the screens. If you don't own a Bible, please take one. We'll find more. We'll get more. We want you to have Bibles as quickly as possible. And don't just rely on the screens above as well. I mean, I'll be pointing back to the text so you see that these are not my thoughts. These aren't my ideas. This is something we're learning together from the Bible about what God has done in Jesus. Romans 15. We who are strong have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. For Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. For whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the scriptures we might have hope. May the God of endurance and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another, in accord with Christ Jesus, that together you may with one voice glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God. For I tell you that Christ became a servant to the circumcised to show God's truthfulness, in order to confirm the promises given to the patriarchs, and in order that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, just context of strong and weak are mentioned in this passage, and if you weren't here last week, just a few pieces about context. Paul is talking about the strong and the weak in this church to live in harmony with one another. He's not talking about the physically strong and the physically weak and how they need to live in harmony with one another. He's talking about matters of conscience and degrees of faith. The strong are strong in faith, and they don't have some of the scruples of those who are weak in faith. We're dealing with matters of conscience here in this passage, and convictions and positions that we can hold as individuals because of culture and family or training that we've gone through and experience. And the strong and weak in faith concern secondary matters, things that are, they feel important and they shape how we live, but they shouldn't be divisive within the church. And when you have a church that's filled with a bunch of different people from different backgrounds, from different ethnicities, from different cultures, different socioeconomic brackets, you're going to have all kinds of areas where people can be offended and it can feel awkward, and where there is temptations to divide over areas of secondary nature. And Paul says we got to learn to live together. And in the first century, some of the things that were concerning the strong and the weak, where the weak were saying that they shouldn't eat meat in the marketplace that was sacrificed in a temple to a god or a goddess, or shouldn't drink wine that was sacrificed because it was that was blessed by a god or a goddess, because it would taint the wine. You'd be participating in idolatry. And for Jewish Christians who grew up celebrating the Sabbath once a week from Friday to Saturday, they wouldn't work. Coming to Jesus and seeing Jesus as the fulfillment of the Sabbath, that was hard work for them. They'd grown up their whole lives thinking we have to set us apart a day not to work. And now Gentile Christians are saying, no, you don't have to do that at all. Not at all. And so in the early church, there was all kinds of room for disagreement, and being strong and weak in conscience in the first century made for hard relationships, And Paul shows us through them how we can live in hard relationships where there's temptations to be easily offended and where it can feel awkward and messy. Paul gives us a relational focus here in this passage. And, you know, one of the beautiful aspects that a hard relationship can give us is it can show us that we need to find some kind of a relational focus. Often when the relationship gets hard, we're asking, why am I staying in this relationship when it is so hard? But what I would recommend is to take that a step farther and say, why are you in any relationship? What's the point of being in any relationship? I mean, we just sort of are in relationships. Why? Why has God made us for relationship? What he's trying to do? What's the goal for relationships? Well, thankfully, God is so kind and good that he tells us what the goal of relationships should be. Every human relationship should have this as a goal. Verse 2, build up your neighbor. That's the goal. Build up your neighbor. Our youngest son, Seth, is 10 years old, and he's in Awana. And a few weeks ago, he was memorizing verse 2. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good to build him up. I'm so grateful that at age 10, he's learning gospel relational wisdom through Awana. Thank you, Awana leaders, for pouring into him. And here Paul gives a gospel focus in this verse. He gives us a simple gospel focus. What's our goal in hard relationships and in easy relationships? What's the focus? To build up our neighbor. To build up our neighbor. I don't know if you've ever thought about what your responsibility is in relationships, but Paul tells us what our responsibility is. He's graciously let us know. Jesus taught this, and Paul repeats it, that our focus in every relationship is to build up our neighbor. And neighbor is a broad term in the Bible. It's a broad term in the Bible. Neighbor includes the people living in our homes. Neighbor includes the people around our homes. It includes our coworkers. It includes our friends, people at church, and virtually every relationship that we're in, other than enemy, is a neighbor. And Jesus even says to love our enemies. And so this focus doesn't go away when relationships get hard. You're in a hard relationship with a neighbor, and Paul says if you're in a hard relationship with a neighbor, that means you should have this focus, which is to seek to do whatever you can to build up that neighbor that you're in a hard relationship with. The focus becomes clear, actually, when the relationship becomes hard. What do I do when this person is being so difficult? Seek to build them up. This word build up is often used by Paul. He likes using it. And building up is not just making somebody feel good. Oh, you build me up so much because I feel so good when I leave your presence. No, that's not what Paul's talking about, though we might feel good when we're being built up. Its background is in the construction world. Any construction workers in here? Project managers, construction? Yeah. So you guys are building up things, right? When you're in construction, you're building things up. You're building. And what Paul's saying is that you and I should see ourselves as workers under God, who's the architect, the chief architect. And he's given us a role and a responsibility in other people's lives, and that is to build other people up. If you remember from Romans 8, Paul says that the goal of every human being, the goal that everyone who loves Jesus, the goal that God has for each of us is that we would look like Jesus. That's his architectural plan for every human being who loves him, that we would look like Jesus. And in our relationships with one another, we're workers under God's architectural plan to build other people up, to help other people look like Jesus. To build up is to do things, so hear this, to build up is to do things in the relationship that help move even the difficult person to love, move them toward Jesus. That move them toward Jesus. Do you see your relationships that way? How can I help other people around me, every neighbor, move closer to Jesus? This is our responsibility, no matter what, Paul says. Husbands and wives, our goal is not just to stay married or to be happy, but to help one another move toward Jesus. Friendship is designed by God to help us move toward Jesus. Where you live by God's design and his plan to help your neighbors move toward Jesus. You work where you work, not just because you want to work there or feel like you need to work there. God has a reason for you to work there, and it's to help your coworkers through your work and doing your job and being there to move toward Jesus. What can this look like, especially when relationships are hard? Scott Sauls has written a book. He's a pastor down in Nashville, Tennessee, and he's written a book called Befriend. The subtitle is Create Belonging in an Age of Judgment, Isolation, and Fear. He talks this way about, or he tells a story about a nursery worker and the beginning of a hard relationship with a mom who had two children in the nursery. Sunday, a woman named Janet, also a first-time visitor at our church, dropped her two boys off in the nursery. After the service, she was waiting in the nursery line to retrieve her boys, and one of the nursery workers quietly approached her and said that there had been some issues with her boys. Both of her boys had picked fights with other children. Also, one of her boys had broken several of the toys that belonged to the church. In front of a room filled with other children and their parents, as soon as the boys came near her, Janet scolded her boys and then yelled out in a bellowing voice an expletive that begins with the letter S. Janet was deeply ashamed and felt like a failure. Janet got to her boys and skulked out of the building. And Scott says, no doubt we were never going to see this woman again. But the nursery worker got Janet's contact information and sent her this note the week after. Dear Janet, I'm so glad that you and your boys visited our church. Oh, and about that little exchange where you picked them up from the nursery, let's just say I just found it so refreshing that you would feel the freedom to speak with an honest vocabulary like that in church. Notice here, she's revealing her heart. I'm really drawn to honesty, and you're clearly an honest person, not trying to put on a face here and be something different someplace else. I hope we can become friends, love, the nursery worker. The nursery worker and Janet did, in fact, become friends. Janet came back the next Sunday. They found out that actually Janet was recovering from heroin addiction. And the Sunday after that, she came back, and the Sunday after that, and eventually Janet became the nursery director for the church. How would you handle that situation? Awkward? Difficult? Oh, great, I got a mom yelling with all these, what are the people going to think? What are the people going to think are using the nursery? What she did, she was honest, and she sought to move this woman closer to Jesus to build her up. When we focus on others, helping move others to Jesus, two extremes are revealed for us to avoid. We have two extremes to avoid. Now, if you ask my family, they would honestly tell you and rightly tell you that when I'm driving down the roads by our home, country roads, narrow ditches on either side, I veer toward the center. I veer toward the center of the road because I do not like the idea of a deer jumping out on the passenger side with me not having the time to react. And I always feel, even though there's just a little bit of a slope, I always feel the convex slope of the road, like it's just pulling me into the ditch. So I want to fight against it and stay in the center. Well, the downside with trying to stay in the center is if you're oncoming traffic, you don't like that. You don't like that, especially coming over the hills by our house. And so I fight to stay in the center, to lean toward the center, but not too far into the center. Now, when we look at relationships and how we enter into relationships, this isn't like driving. You want to stay in the center because there's two ditches that we need to avoid. Two ditches, relational ditches that we need to avoid. The first one is people pleasing. People pleasing. Now, a quick view of verse 2 would seem to point to the direction of this relational ditch, quite frankly. Let each one of us please our neighbor, please our neighbor, please your neighbor. It seems like people pleasing is what we're called to do, but that's a distinction. There's a distinction that we need to make between people pleasing and pleasing our neighbor. Why? Well, because people pleasing is actually motivated not by love for other people, it's actually motivated by fear of them. By fear of other people. People pleasing can seem like love for neighbor, and it can seem like building up because we're Minnesota, Wisconsin nice to other people. And we seek to do what they might expect. And when we do what they expect, they're happy. And if we gauge our love for other people based on how happy people are with us, we're in a big mess of people pleasing. People pleasing actually isn't loving others. It's actually focused on people thinking well of us. It's actually selfish. I please others because I want them to be happy with me, and if they're happy with me, I'm doing quite well, thank you very much. And what is sad, and again, what is fascinating about people pleasing as a relational pattern is that people pleasing is selfish. People pleasers, I count myself as one of them, are addicted to the feeling of meeting somebody else's expectations and needs. It's actually about us when we're trying to relate to them. But people pleasing is actually self-destructive. You'll destroy yourself trying to please other people. And so there's a little phrase that Paul uses in this section to distinguish people pleasing from pleasing your neighbor. It's this phrase, for his or her good. For his or her good, in verse 2. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good. That means that we can't be people pleasers because sometimes people will not be pleased if we seek their good. Parents, you know this. Buying a share size bag of peanut butter M&Ms, and I give some to our boys when they are younger. Now they buy their own, and I'm mooching off of them. But when I used to buy all their treats, give them some peanut butter M&Ms, and I keep the rest for myself. They gobble them up. I like to savor them. My dentist doesn't like that. I like to suck on them and enjoy the peanut butter and chocolate goo. My boys eat them up quickly, and then what do they want? Mine, right? If I was a people pleaser, here you go. Stop crying. Stop whining. Here you go. But out of love for them, I say no. No. You are so cynical. So cynical, I've taught you well. There's some selfishness in there. Ideally speaking, out of love for them, I say no. Why? Because when we seek to please our neighbor for their good, we don't seek to do everything they expect us to do or want them to do. We have a bigger goal. How do we move them closer to Jesus? How do we move them closer to Jesus? The goal is to build up, to help another move forward toward Jesus, to learn how to do good to one another. All the one another commands in the Bible. Look them up. Go to blueletter.com or something like that. Look them up, or .org, I don't remember what it is. Look them up. Look at all the one another commands. They'll show us what to do to build others up, to do good. The other ditch is a reaction to pleasing others. It's pleasing self. And I've seen this in my own life. I've seen it in the lives of others, that people wake up and they start seeing that they're pleasing other people, and that's a relational pattern, and then they get empowered to leave people pleasing behind. And the other option is, if you're not going to please other people, what am I going to do? I'm going to please myself. It's about self-fulfillment in our relationships then. I desire to be who I really am. I'm tired of pleasing others. I'm going to live my own life and do what I want, and others are just going to have to deal with it, quite frankly. If they love me, then they'll deal with me. Maybe you remember these words. The snow glows white on the mountain tonight. Not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation. It looks like I'm the queen. The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in. Heaven knows I've tried. Don't let them in. Don't let them see. Be the good girl always. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal. Don't feel. Don't let them know. Well, now they know. Thank you. Thank you. Let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. Let the storm rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway. What is that? That's a shift from people-pleasing to self-pleasing. In a song, won awards, celebrated by countless little girls around the world. The temptation when relationships are hard is to let it go and don't care what they're going to say. The effect that our decisions have on others is no longer our concern. I need to be true to me. I need to focus on caring for me, pleasing myself, in other words. If they don't like it, well, that's their problem. Now, there's a little bit of truth in this. A little bit. How other people respond to us really is their responsibility. We can't make other people mad. But that's not the reason that we should disregard the impact of our decisions on others. I mean, just think about it. Just remember all the snowy and icy destruction that Ilsa brought on the kingdom when she sought self-fulfillment. Can't go that route either. If we view the meaning of life to be about self-fulfillment, then we're going to use people for what they can give us. Will they help us fulfill our dreams when the relationship becomes hard and others become difficult? Will we discard them? When it feels like we're putting more into the relationship than we're getting out of it, we wonder, is it worth the time and the investment of energy? We start to look at people and relationships as commodities. From what I've read, self-fulfillment is the drive behind, was the drive behind Hugh Hefner. If we live to please self, we will tear other people down. We will become the one making the relationship difficult. Truth to be told, I vacillate between both of these extremes, left to myself. Left to myself, I will want to define the people that I really want to please, and then I'll define the people who I don't really care to please, and I'll just please myself. Left to myself, I will be evaluating relationships by how much I get out of them and whether the investment I make is worth the return. Left to myself, I'll either feel used and destroy my life by trying to please people, or I will use and destroy others because of pleasing myself. How do we stay in the middle? How do we stay in the middle? What Paul shows us is that what we need at our core is an experience with a perfect neighbor, to be loved and to know how to love. When relationships are hard, like I said, they reveal something about my heart, and it's that you and I, if you pay attention, you and I actually have an expectation. We live with an expectation to be loved perfectly. Did you know that? One of the reasons why we find ourselves in hard relationships, when we call them hard relationships, is because we're not being loved the way that we believe that we're supposed to be loved. But there's really only one person who can actually love us perfectly, and it's the perfect neighbor. Jesus himself. If we want to live in the center and not fall into those ditches, we have to have an encounter with the perfect neighbor and his love for us. We need to stop looking for other people to love us perfectly because they won't and they can't. And we turn that expectation into being loved by Jesus, the perfect neighbor, experiencing his love. It answers that heart desire that we all have to be loved perfectly. And as we breathe in God's grace, as we breathe in the gospel, we're actually able to live it out in relationship with other people. My awe and gratitude for Jesus' perfect love for me is actually compounded when I realize that I'm actually the difficult one in relationship with him. I'm the difficult one. Jesus is in a hard relationship, and he's in a hard relationship with me. He's in a hard relationship with you. And not only am I the difficult one in the relationship with Jesus, it's very possible that I'm the difficult one in relationships with other people. Crazy. What's wrong with you people, right? No, just kidding. But then take it a step further. All my rebellion against Jesus by either people pleasing or pleasing myself, all of it cost him his life that he willingly gave. Jesus willingly died for us, and he died in our place, taking the insults on himself that are due to us because of all of us have not loved our neighbors as we ought. To see Jesus as the perfect neighbor, again, it's an experience. It's an experience with the God who is really there. It's not just cognitive. It's an experience with the God who's really there. But the cognitive pieces are these two in understanding our relationship to Jesus and his relationship to us. First, if we want to stay in the middle and avoid the two ditches, we see that Jesus was a perfect neighbor for us. What I mean by that is that Jesus actually lived the perfect neighbor life in our place for us. He's done what we can't do. We don't have to try to become the perfect neighbor. He's already done that for us in our place. And we are seen because we belong to Jesus. We're actually seen as perfect neighbors because Jesus was perfect for us. What he did is given to us as a gift. What he accomplished is credited to our account. So we can actually know how to be good neighbors by following after Jesus' ways. But we don't have the pressure of like, ooh, I gotta perform, because Jesus already performed for us. But on the other side, Jesus was crucified as if he was the worst enemy of humanity, and he did it for us in our place. For all the ways in which we have not loved our neighbors well, Jesus actually took that upon himself as well. We've all blown it in loving others. We've all been the difficult one in relationships. And our sins against our neighbors are paid for by Jesus' death as well. And when our hearts experience Jesus is the perfect neighbor for us, we're freed to remain. We're freed, we're empowered, we're encouraged, we're given the courage to remain in hard relationships, to build up our neighbors, to help move them toward Jesus. We're freed to remain, even when we're hurt in relationships, or we feel like we're giving more than we're getting. Jesus gave more than he gets from us. He encourages us to do that. So we don't please ourselves anymore, because Jesus is the perfect neighbor who seeks our good. He knows us completely and loves us fully. And once we've tasted what real neighbor love is like with an encounter with Jesus, once we've tasted what real neighbor love is like, we're not going to be content to live pleasing people. We're going to seek their good. Seek their good and help everyone that we're relating to move toward Jesus. The twin fears of the human heart are to be fully known but not fully loved, or to be loved and not fully known. The perfect neighbor, our Lord, knows us fully and loves us completely. And he's won us to himself in the ways that he wants us to live in relationship to our neighbors. Will you please stand as we pray? Merciful Father, I ask that you would help us to look at every relationship and every human being that we interacted with, whether it's just for a moment or whether or not it's for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Would you please help us to seek to do